Good morning and welcome to today's edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan and these are the top stories of the day.
Trump Health Secretary Tom Price resigns after private plane scandal. By Philip Elliott. Tom Price, the embattled Health and Human Services Secretary, whose use of costly private jets put him on the outs with President Donald Trump, resigned under pressure on Friday. Price, the first member of the president's cabinet to leave the administration, spent more than $1 million on private jets to ferry him to Europe, Asia, and around the U.S. The revelation left the White House embarrassed and angry, Republicans in Congress fuming about waste, and the president himself worried about how it would look. Price attempted to calm the furor, offering to cover some of the costs, including a $25,000 trip from Washington, D.C. to Philadelphia. But in the end, Trump had seen enough. As he left the White House on Friday afternoon, he said cryptically that he'd soon decide Price's fate. But shortly after Trump landed in New Jersey on his way to his nearby golf club, the White House press office released a statement saying that Price had offered to resign and the White House had accepted. The quick exit was unlikely to end the problems of private planes for the Trump team. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin, Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke, and EPA Chief Scott Pruitt had their own transportation issues brewing, and there's no telling if others in the president's ultra-wealthy cabinet have used private aircraft instead of opting to use the government discount on major commercial carriers as is preferred. Republicans and Democrats on the Hill are demanding answers, and perhaps scalps. Trump ran for office pledging to drain the swamp and to end business as usual in Washington. Instead, his team appears to have engaged in the exact types of offenses he said vanquished Democratic rival Hillary Clinton represented. Trump's voters, many of whom cheered Trump's attacks on elitism, stand to sour on the president if he turns out to be just like any other politician, a busy individual who is unable to police everyone on his team. Price, a surgeon by training, was elected to Congress in 2004 and was a favorite among the conservative wing of his party. He stepped down from his seat earlier this year to guide health policy for the new-to-Washington president. Yet efforts to scalp Obamacare as promised never came, and the existing health care system has proved wobblier than perhaps Trump realized. Trump had considered dumping Price after the first time health care faltered, but decided to keep him on. That was before his travel schedules became a political liability. The best Trump could muster when asked Wednesday about his HHS chief was a coy, we'll see. By Friday evening, everyone saw, yet again, the limits of president's loyalty and the frail hold anyone in Trump's orbit has on his or her job. I have spent 40 years both as a doctor and a public servant putting people first. I regret that recent events have created a distraction from these important objectives, Price wrote in his letter of resignation. Success on these issues is more important than any one person. In order for you to move forward without further disruption, I am officially tendering my resignation. An image of an NFL player burning the U.S. flag is circulating on social media. It's fake. By Eric Jenkins. Amid heightened tensions between the NFL and President Donald Trump, an image of one of the league's players burning the American flag is circulating around the internet. It's fake. The photograph, which has made its way across Facebook and Twitter, shows Seattle Seahawks defensive end Michael Bennett enthusiastically burning the flag in a locker room as his teammates and head coach Pete Carroll happily look on. The picture is photoshopped. The majority of the scene in the image is real, evidenced by a tweet from the Seattle Seahawks official Twitter account in January 2016. At Seahawks, what do you do in the victory locker room? You victory dance. Hashtag C versus AZ. But there is no flag, and there is certainly no fire. But that didn't stop people from sharing the doctored image. Even some anti-NFL users could see the image is fake. For one, Bennett's hand holding the flag looks off. And two, no sprinklers are going off as a fire burns in a public building. Time has reached out to the Seattle Seahawks and will update if the organization comments.
Puerto Rico's devastated electric grid could be a big opportunity for renewable energy, by Justine Warland. Even before Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico, the island's electric grid was in bad shape. Nearly half the country's electricity came from expensive oil shipped to the island. power outages occurred frequently, and electricity prices were higher than anywhere else in the U.S., except Hawaii. The territory's electric authority, mired in debt, could not afford to fix the problem. Those problems now seem minor by comparison. The vast majority of the island's population is currently living without power. Authorities acknowledge they need months before power returns to some regions. Still, energy experts say the rebuilding effort offers a unique opportunity to outfit the island with the electric grid of the future, a state-of-the-art system built from scratch using renewable energy sources like wind and solar, which would be cheaper to operate and would respond better to the next hurricane. The reimagined grid would rely on the concept of a microgrid, which are localized electric grids that allow communities to keep power even if centralized power plants are not functioning. Microgrids incorporate small-scale power plants. Think small solar arrays or a couple of wind turbines, as well as energy storage solutions like batteries to keep electricity flowing. Transmission lines can connect microgrids to the wider grid, but the link is not necessary. The idea was touted on Friday by Puerto Rico Governor Ricardo Rosello, who said he was considering it as one possible step for the island territory of 3.4 million. "We can start dividing Puerto Rico into different regions and then start developing microgrids," says Rosello. "That's not going to solve the problem, but it's certainly going to start lighting up Puerto Rico much quicker." Moving to energy sources like wind and solar also makes sense from an economic perspective, according to energy policy experts. Using microgrids would mean that the island could avoid investing in expensive long-distance transmission lines, which could easily be destroyed by the next storm. Wind and solar would also allow Puerto Rico to move away from oil, a relatively expensive commodity when compared to other electricity sources. If the standard was that Puerto Rico should procure the cheapest electricity for its residents, it's not oil, says Jeff Navin, a former deputy chief of staff at the U.S. Department of Energy. Solar and wind, and frankly anything else, are going to be much cheaper. Despite these advantages, there are no guarantees Puerto Rico will move to a renewable smart grid as it rebuilds. Prior to Maria, the island's energy authorities were slow to move toward renewables, instead planning a transition to natural gas that included a $380 million liquefied natural gas terminal. Natural gas, the cheapest source of electricity in many parts of the country, provides the most logical alternative to wind and solar in Puerto Rico. But a number of barriers remain, including the high capital costs of building new transmission lines. The challenge of getting natural gas to the island is compounded by the Jones Act, a federal law that requires such shipments to be made on U.S.-made ships. Perhaps more importantly, Republican officials in Washington will need to sign off on recovery funding. In the past, many have shown little enthusiasm for renewable energy sources. The Trump administration has launched a number of initiatives in recent months aimed at improving the coal, nuclear, and oil and gas industries. Indeed, Energy Secretary Rick Perry suggested this week that the next generation of nuclear power plants may be the right solution for Puerto Rico, though realistically such a solution would take years to complete. Wouldn't it make abundant good sense if we had small modular reactors that literally you could put in the back of a C-17 military cargo aircraft, transport it to an area like Puerto Rico, and push it out the back end, crank it up, and plug it in? He asked a clean energy gathering this week, according to a Bloomberg BNA report. If Puerto Rico wants to restore electricity to the island as quickly as possible over the coming months, nuclear power is not the fastest solution. But whatever the island does, it will likely need the support of Republicans to help pay for it. With reporting from Carl Vick, San Juan, Puerto Rico.
The Dark Side of Electric Cars, Exploitative Labor Practices, by Mark Dummett. Dummett is business and human rights researcher at Amnesty International. The Scottish government recently announced plans to, by 2032, phase out petrol and diesel vehicles. By 2040, the only cars on United Kingdom roads will also be electric, and petrol stations will be replaced by car charging points. Meanwhile, in the United States, Elon Musk has announced the launch of the Tesla Model 3, which he hopes will become the world's first mass-market electric car. This shift to green technology is extremely welcome. Climate change is one of the biggest human rights challenges of our time, and cities from London to Delhi are choking on vehicle fumes.
The move to electric cars will improve air quality and cut the carbon emissions that have pushed our planet to the breaking point. But some electric cars are not currently as ethically clean as manufacturers would have us believe. Amnesty International's research has shown that cobalt mined by children and adults in extremely hazardous conditions could be entering the supply chains of some of the world's largest car makers. A key component of the rechargeable lithium-ion batteries on which electric cars run is cobalt. More than half of the world's cobalt comes from the Democratic Republic of Congo, the DRC. Despite its mineral riches, the DRC is one of the poorest countries in the world and has suffered from decades of war and corrupt leaders. With so few formal jobs in the country, hundreds of thousands of Congolese men, women, and children have been driven to dig their own mines to earn their livelihoods. Government officials told us that 20% of the cobalt exported from the DRC comes from these so-called artisanal miners. The true figure is likely higher. The artisanal mines produce cheaper cobalt than industrial mines, partly because people are paid so little and are unregulated, and as demand has grown, we've heard of new mine sites being developed across the region. What this means is that a huge amount of the global cobalt supplies comes from these mines. While we do not know where most of it ends up, it's reasonable to assume that it's entering the supply chains of the handful of companies which dominate the car battery market. Working with a Congolese NGO, AfriWatch, Amnesty International found children as young as 7 in the mining areas. None of the adult or child miners we saw wore face masks that could prevent them from inhaling cobalt dust, which could lead to potentially fatal lung disease. Mines collapse frequently, burying people underground. No one knows the exact figure, but UNICEF estimates that 40,000 children work in mining across the south of the DRC where cobalt is found. Using company records, our investigation into the supply of cobalt traced it from the mines in the DRC to Chinese buying companies and smelters through battery component manufacturers in China and South Korea and on to battery makers who supply many of the world's leading electric car companies. So, what should these companies be doing? In 2012, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, laid out clear guidelines for companies sourcing cobalt and other minerals from high-risk areas like the DRC. According to these guidelines, electric car manufacturers and battery makers should be able to say who their smelters or refiners are and should make public their own assessment of whether the smelters' due diligence practices are adequate in identifying and addressing human rights risks and abuses. We've contacted many of the largest companies, and not a single car manufacturer told us they actually had done this. This could be because cobalt has been overlooked by narrowly drafted conflict minerals rules adopted in the United States in 2010 and the European Union earlier this year, meaning it escapes strict regulation. But there's no excuse for some of the richest companies in the world not to undertake proper due diligence. Since our report came out in 2016, there has been some progress. Several companies, including some from China, have formed a body called the Responsible Cobalt Initiative to help the industry conduct due diligence in line with the OECD standards and tackle the issue of child labor in the DRC. They include leading tech firms such as Apple, HP, Huawei, and Sony, as well as Samsung SDI, a battery manufacturer, and Huayu Cobalt, a smelter and refiner whose subsidiary purchases cobalt from artisanal mines. None of the members of this group is as yet a car maker. Meanwhile, in the DRC, the government announced that it would take action to eliminate child labor in its mines by 2025 and appealed for international help to do so. The electric car industry must understand that transparency of human rights risks abuses arising in their supply chains is the way forward. I've been told by numerous executives from different global brands how difficult it is to map the cobalt supply chain. But surely any responsible company, understanding that there's a risk of child labor, should make every effort possible to understand who their suppliers are and the conditions under which their components were produced. Earlier this year, Apple became the first company to publish the names of their cobalt suppliers, proving that it can be done. Which car maker will win the race to do likewise? The other response we hear from companies is that they want to stop buying from artisanal mines in the DRC altogether, but this could have a negative impact on the already impoverished communities that rely on mining. Companies that have benefited from child labor should not just walk away from the problem now that it's been exposed. The solution lies in regulating these artisanal mines, ensuring that they are safe places to work while children attend school instead. Governments around the world should pass laws that require companies to check and publicly disclose information about where they source materials. The voluntary approach is not enough. This does not have to be a choice between two evils. We need to phase out fossil fuels, and electric cars are an integral part of a greener future. But as electric car manufacturers move to the forefront of the market, they need to drastically improve their practices and take steps to ensure that their role in the energy revolution is truly clean and fair. A green future built on the backs of exploited children in the DRC is no kind of progress. 5 times Yosemite National Park turned deadly, by Julia Zorthian. The natural wonders of Yosemite National Park are so striking that it's possible to forget that a visit to the park can turn deadly. But the rockfall that killed one and injured another on Wednesday is a stark example of how the park claims lives each year. Many people witnessed as the giant slab of granite cascaded off the massive monolith El Capitan near an area popular with hikers. Some deaths result from climbing accidents, while others take place when visitors take their own safety for granted. And many are just freak accidents, reminders that venturing into the wild always has dangers associated with it. Since thousands of people visit Yosemite annually, the numerical probability of death is very low. People dying while visiting the park has been well documented since recording began nearly 170 years ago, though. One ecologist even wrote a whole book about it in 2007 called Off the Wall, Death in Yosemite, to warn people about taking necessary precautions. Here are some of the most notable recent deaths that have taken place at Yosemite due to a wide range of accidents. 2015. Renowned rock climber Dean Potter, 43, died while base jumping off Taft Point. He and a fellow climber, 29-year-old Graham Hunt, were killed slamming into cliffs they failed to avoid. A GoPro camera mounted on Potter's helmet captured the moments before his death. 2014. Brad Parker, 36, fell to his death while rock climbing mere hours after his girlfriend accepted his marriage proposal in the park. After calling his father to say it was the happiest day of his life, Parker decided to climb Mathis Crest alone. The yoga instructor had completed the climb before and was on an established route without climbing equipment when he fell 300 feet to his death. 2011. 3 people in their 20s fell to their deaths together in the cascade of the 317-foot Vernal Fall. The group had disregarded safety fences and signs and were reportedly having fun in the area before 2 slipped into the water and a 3rd tried to save them. Nearby hikers described the horrifying scene of seeing the 3 people swept over the ridge. The deaths taking place in a clearly marked danger zone threw a national spotlight on the importance of safety measures in the park. 1996. The massive Yosemite Valley landslide of 1996 killed 1 person and injured several more when a 200-foot-long granite chunk slid down a cliff into the Happy Isles Trail, where people often hike. The impact of the 162,000 tons of rock was roughly equivalent to the strength of a 2.15 magnitude earthquake. Witnesses said it took nearly 45 minutes for the dust to settle so recovery efforts could begin. 1985. When lightning hit 5 hikers on top of the renowned Half Dome, 2 were killed and 3 were injured. The group had been sitting on top of a cavern when the lightning struck. The National Park Service now recounts the incident as reason to take lightning precautions when visiting Yosemite. Review: American Made Lets a Smug Tom Cruise Just Be Tom Cruise by Stephanie Zacharik. The trademark Tom Cruise character is the cat that eats the canary, looks around to make sure everyone knows how awesome he is for getting away with eating said canary, and then eats 10 more. Cruise was practically born to star in Doug Liman's American Made as Barry Seal, a one-time TWA pilot from Louisiana who smuggled drugs for the Medellin cartel before becoming a DEA informant. In real life, Seal got away with all kinds of audaciousness, though the odds did catch up with him. He was murdered in 1986 by Medellin assassins. In American Made, Barry gets away with even more. We watch as he goes to work for the CIA. His handler is a classically inscrutable government foot soldier, played by Domhnall Gleeson, then enters a deal with a wily Pablo Escobar henchman, Alejandro Edda. Before long, he's diverting guns meant for Nicaraguan Contras to Colombian drug lords, grinning all the way. Once in a while, he expresses vague worries about the safety of his family, including multiple tykes and his seemingly smart but still inexplicably loyal wife Lucy, Sarah Wright. Cruz plays Barry as an aw-shucks raconteur, and the routine is amusing at first. But midway through American Made, even Cruz devotees might decide enough is enough. At one point, Barry gets thrown in a scary Latin American jail and loses a tooth along the way, his temporary jack-o'-lantern smile shining like a beacon of human vulnerability. Cruz lets us have a laugh over it, but that tooth gets fixed pretty fast. We're allowed to laugh with him, not at him. In the Cruz universe, our job is to admire. Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.